And two of these arrows jump out of a window, try to give up, see? And opposite all the boys with the guns, and they shot him. All his brain was in my shoulder. I was very upset there because they could have shot me, see?
This is Cold War Conversations.
In the early hours of the morning, Soviet troops have started an attack against the Hungarian capital with the apparent purpose of overthrowing the local democratic government of the country. Our troops are engaged in battle with the Soviet forces.
If you're new here, you've come to the right place to listen to first-hand Cold War history accounts. Do make sure you follow us in your podcast app so that you don't miss out on future episodes. Charlie was 17 in 1956. A trip home from work by tram ended up with him being thrust into the heart of the Hungarian Revolution of 1956, a nationwide revolution against the Hungarian People's Republic and its Soviet-imposed policies. I'm in conversation with Charlie and his daughter Angela as Charlie describes how he and his friends attacked the communist-held Budapest radio station and graphically details his experiences and what he saw during those momentous days. He also recalls his escape from Hungary and his later life in Wales, as well as his return to the country of his birth while it was still within the Warsaw Pact orbit. I do really need your help to allow me to find the time to continue producing and preserving these Cold War stories. All I'm asking is for listeners to pledge a monthly donation of at least $4, £3 or €3 a month to help keep the podcast on the air, although larger amounts are welcome too. It's dead easy and you can cancel at any time. As a thank you, you will get the sought-after Cold War Conversations coaster, and you will bask in the warm glow of knowing that you are helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate. I'm delighted to welcome Charlie and Angela to our Cold War conversation.
Oh, I born in the lowland in Hungary in 1937. By Debrecen, Hajdú Szovák.
And what work did your parents do?
Oh, they're farmers.
What was their view of the Hungarian government after the war?
Not very good, because we have been deported from the land, because those days the richest people have been deported all over the country, not Siberia or anywhere, but one place to another,
So that was that around like collectivization?
You're correct.
Right. Okay. What was your childhood like? Was it a good childhood?
Well, it was great. I can't complain, because we was quite well off. There's no problem at all. We was. And when I went to 16, 17, when we have been left a little town where our farm was, because they call it Tila, we went to just outside Budapest, in the commuter belt of Budapest. It wasn't bad at all.
Right, yeah, because I was going to ask you how you ended up in Budapest. So you're living on the outskirts. What was your job in 1956? What were you working as?
Apprentice engineer.
Okay, apprentice engineer. And on the 23rd of October, you're on a tram, I understand.
Oh, I was. Coming home from work.
Right. So tell me about that journey back from work and what happened on that day.
Well, I tell you what, because the young wasn't political minded, we take free tram to take home, because it was get up a first tram. As a big lorries was there, which full of machine guns. Unbelievable it was. and everybody come on as a revolution, and everybody had a guns, machine gun. We gone to the radio station to take a radio station up. So I said, it was news to me, you know. I mean, I know it was a bit of a student was demonstrating, but I would never take any notice, you know. I mean, I was only 18 or something, you know. So, and I ended up in the radio station. Took us all night, after all night before we break into the radio station and take it over. But the security police was in the Avi. I was in the radio station. And it was fighting there for all night. Yeah.
Right. And had you ever handled a submachine gun before?
Yes, yes. I mean, we've been when we were young, we were treating guns, really, and machine guns. You know, in other territorial things, everybody got to have a uniform there. Even apprentices got to have uniform and training and parachuting and whatever it is.
Yeah.
You know, yeah.
You went to attack the radio station. So the AVH were...
in there.
And when you approached, were they, I presume they were firing at you?
Actually, they wasn't firing because it was so many so many of us opposite and things. They was afraid to fire out, but they wasn't let us into the, it was a big iron gate. So, but they wasn't firing, they was afraid to fire him because they know that there's nobody helping them because the Russians has gone out. So by the morning, they have tried to give up. And although I said to my daughter, I said, I was standing by the big iron gate, and two disavows jump out, out of a window, try to give up, see? And opposite all the boys with the guns, and they shot him. All his brain was in my shoulder. I was very upset there because they could have shot me, see? But because I was in between. So in the end, it's the big gate opened and we all got in. I was one of the first to push in the damn thing, you know, I mean. But all of those gone. I think they gone through the roof or something. I see a couple of them dead in there, but... that's why I didn't commit suicide, but I don't really know. But it was empty, but I think they gonna escape through the roof. But I don't know, I'm just surmising, but that's what it was.
Because the RVO were particularly hated, weren't they?
Hate were, yes. I seen it, I don't know if you've seen it in, when he got the RVO, they hung him and, you know, they no mercy for the Avos. It was a lot of them died.
Yeah, I saw. I think I saw some photos around the attack on the Parliament building where some of them were thrown from the rooftop and yeah, shot outside and
yeah. Most of it was in, I don't know, Kostashchak, Trier, Sabachak. Square when a political party headquarters was. That was the worst for them. Oh, I wasn't there actually when they, but people have gone in there and dragged them out and they, oh, it was sort of a, if you see it and I got papers, you see it, they've been hanging by the legs and things like that. It was cruel.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I've seen those photos, and they are particularly shocking. So when you capture the radio station with your fellow revolutionaries, how did you feel at that time?
Oh, good, yeah. Good, because we was free then, you know. We went to after the tour, we went to the cinema was there called a Corwin Cinema. That's where we have. Stayed for two nights and days, and after that, believe it or not, I walked home, and that was about, I would have say about, oh, I don't know, over 20 miles. I just followed a tram route because it wasn't tram. Yeah.
So what were the scenes like around the Corvin cinema? Because I believe that the Killian barracks was also in that vicinity.
We had a gun there, ordinary gun, and every time a tongue's passed, easy to shoot out, like shooting turkeys, you know. Yeah, but man, that was a big fight was in the Corvin, you know. It took, but after that, a Russian gun out, and it wasn't any Russians gone out after, you see.
That's right. So the Russians withdrew, and so did you believe at that point that you'd won freedom?
I don't know. I mean, I only was 18. You know, I mean, I can't. I know that we was free. Everything was open, and you know, people was start taking revenge and whatever it is, but not till when they come back in the 4th of November, isn't it? But then I was home in the house. But we went in there. The tram was running for a bit. We went in there, but the Russian was coming in with tanks. So we can't do against. Mind, they lost a lot of tanks there, but can't do against that against much of tanks, you see. Not with machine guns and grenade.
No. So were you involved in the fighting on the 4th of November?
No, I wasn't involved because it wasn't organized fight then, not before. It was just group fighting, see, and it wasn't anybody to give you orders or something. So we just got home to the Balint in outside Buddha, I'm talking about. But I seen it fighting, you know, in radio and heard, but it was a heavy fighting, but I wasn't in it then. No, only the first fighting I was in.
Right. And in that first fighting, you know, did you actually fire your weapon during that, or was it just other people?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes, sir. Fired it many times. I fired in the radio station. I fired in the Corvin cinema. You have to, you know, you have to. You either kill or get killed, you know. There's no what you call it. No talk about it.
No, understood. I mean, it's difficult for people nowadays to sort of imagine the situation you were in. So, you know, I'm interested to hear how did you feel about, you know, because if you're firing a machine gun, you know, you're hurting people or killing people. How did you feel about that?
Well, that's what I'd say, that we have to do it and just follow the your friends and the crowd. We have to do it, you know. It's nothing about it, you know. You've got to do it. Yeah. And that's it.
Yeah, because I believe on that first day as well, the Hungarian army, some of them joined the revolution.
Oh, yes, it did. I remember when we were a radio station, see, it's a Hungarian officer, how you call it, Sandhurst and Hungarian. These boys was coming in, you know, Hungarian, you know, cadet. And I know one of them because we were school together, and I told him, I said, what are you doing here? He said, we come to help that Arvo. I said, you don't even say that because you'll be all shot. And all of a sudden, they all got off lorry and they just disappeared.
Right.
I mean, because they was communist. They don't want to, you know, but they just disappeared. I told him, I said, don't even say things like that because you shot you in a minute. But I tell you, a tanks come there. I don't know where come the Hungarian tanks, and he's supposed to shoot in us. But he was just standing there, stopped the engine, and nobody come out. He was standing there for all night, all day, don't done anything. Just people were sitting in the tank and they can't move. He tried to knock him coming out, no. In the end, they gone somewhere. I don't know where.
Yeah, because I've seen photos of one of the officers who came over to the revolution, Pal Molotov.
Molotov, yes. Yeah. A big tall fella.
Yeah, he's huge. I couldn't believe how tall he was.
Oh, they hanged him. Oh, they went to talk to the Russians before Russians come out, and they, the Kadar, prime minister, hanged him. Sure, he shouldn't have gone to talk to Russian because you can't trust him, you see.
So when, you know, after the capture of the radio station, you know, you're over at the Corvin cinema.
Yeah.
Are you, with your friends, are you talking about what Hungary should be like in the future? You know, how things should be?
You see, actually, we won't because we was too young for that. We said, I will be better, it will be free, because we wasn't all that free. We couldn't say what we want, you know. I mean, it was ruled by the government. But it wasn't all that bad for us, you know. But for older people, you know, the workers, and they was pushed down, you see. Well, I just end of apprenticeship, but in the end, we said, because we have to do it. But after November 4th, we know we lost because nobody else came in to help us anyway. So not against the Russian, but all those Mongolians coming in, I don't know.
Yeah, yeah. So when you walked all that distance back to your home, presumably where your parents live, this was.
Yeah.
When you met them, presumably they were worried that you'd been killed.
Oh, they don't know about 3 days, 3 nights, you know. They were glad to see me anyway. Yeah, because a lot of people died on the first. People was dying all over the place. All, you see, dead bodies. A lot of revenge killing as well, you see. You see the policemen, they don't help, but I have a lot of policemen on the road, dead, I don't know.
Hi, this is Rhonda in Virginia, and I support Cold War Conversations because I think the work that Ian is doing is critically important. I think it's vital to record the firsthand accounts of people who lived and experienced the Cold War because it illustrates history in a way that a book never can. So thank you so much for the podcast. It's my favorite podcast, and I look forward to it every week.
To be like Rhonda and help to preserve these incredible stories of the Cold War. As a monthly or annual supporter, you'll be able to listen ad-free, you'll become one of our community, get the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster as a thank you, and you'll bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate to find out more.
So anybody who had any association with the regime was a target.
Oh, that's a target, you know, and it's a lot of them. So my only the part people, you know, but, you know what we say, the commissars.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So did you take your machine gun home with you?
No. No, I won't carry it all the way back. I mean, left it in the Corvin.
In the Corvin.
It's one of the young boy was living around there. He said he wanted it. So I said, you can have it. Because if I was taken home, I could be shot by some obvious, somebody else in walking in that tram line home, because I have to go to forest as well, you see, when I walk to the tram line.
Right. So the Soviets come back on the 4th of November. What do you hear or see that day?
Oh, well, they was started shooting anybody moved in the windows and things, they was shooting everybody. They were shooting, you got the tanks, a hell of a lot of tanks coming. And not many soldiers coming after, because they learned that soldier on foot, they don't get the chance because they're always shooting them. So tanks come in and shoot everything up. after that, a big army coming, old, huge, hell of a lot of army coming. So that's it. I seen them all, they come in. But as the armies wasn't, when the army come in, the Russian armies, well, they don't do much. You know, it wasn't revenge, I would say, but after that, when we come out, after that, the revenge started by the Hungarian government, with puppet government, you see, that's what it was. Because we was coming out, I come into this country in January 1957, but I was in Austria for in the camp. All the Hungarian went to Austria, because like Austro-Hungarian monarch, everybody go to Austria, see. But after that, it's just I heard, and I got a lot of books, how many people have been hanged and shot. Ooh, I got all the photos in at home in a book. And most, a lot of them was apprentices like me, been shot.
Because they were under suspicion that they'd been fighting on the side of the revolution.
Oh, yeah. There was a lot of people been shot.
Could you in any way stay in contact with people that were still in Hungary, or was that impossible?
Well, from here?
Yeah.
No, I could send the letters straight away, but I can't go home. You're not allowed to home. Or we could send letters in there. I don't know what it because the second, this communist government, Kádár, wasn't so Bolshevik like a government before that. Because I think they learned something, that you can't keep a people down. And there was, not only that, the Russian have sent a hell of a lot of money in to help the economy, see? But Russians was frightened about if anything happened somewhere else. So they kept the Hungarian sweet. So in 1968, I was a British subject, and they let me home without any problem at all. And it was a communist government then, but...
Right.
A revolution done something good, because it wasn't any security police. It was freer than before, because I think the whole government afraid of for another revolution, whatever it was. I wouldn't have it happened, but it was more free. And of course, the Russians understand that, and they do financially or something, but Russia is a big country, helped. Okay, I think, I don't know, but that was much better after the revolution.
Well, I've read that Hungary became more of a liberal communist country. But did you say that you were able to, you became a British citizen, and therefore you were able to visit Hungary in 1968?
Yes, me and my wife.
And your daughter.
And my daughter. Yes, we are visited, yeah. We used to go for a month, no problem at all.
And what was that like, being, you know, going back for the first time in 15 years?
It was very good, very nice, and nice to see the people was free. As I say, they wasn't afraid for nobody. They was going to the pubs, drinking or singing. The people wasn't afraid. That's what it is. Say what they like, but they wasn't afraid. Anything gets there. And that's what the revolution done for him, that made him a bit freer.
Yeah.
Only thing you have to change, you know, when I was going, we're going home by car, you see, and there's a hell of a lot of Hungarian come to the west in Europe. And, you know, on the border, queuing up to go into Hungary, you've got to have a visa, of course, we've got to have a visa. We have to have every person got to have to change, I think, £100. So me and my wife have to change £200. We had enough money there, but we couldn't spend it. But everybody have to, I remember it, the big chest, the tea chest there full of foreign monies, and we had foreign. But foreign was so sort of a, we just can't spend so much foreign, because thing was cheaper there. See, as it was, thing was cheaper than, the pint of beer was cost, I don't know, that was it. A shilling or something, old shilling, something like that, you know.
Yeah, yeah. No, I went to Poland and Czechoslovakia in the early 1980s, and yeah, it was such a cheap holiday. It was incredible. Can I just ask you about how you got to Austria? So you say you got there in 1957. So you stayed in Hungary for a few months and then realized that you needed to get out.
Well, 57, a couple of weeks where we come to the train up to Gera, and from there we walked all the way, and I think it was snow, and I remember snow, big snow.
Can I just ask you, you got the train from where? From Turek Balint?
Yeah, to Gjør.
And how far is that from the Austrian border?
I don't know, 100 kilometres or something.
So you had to walk the 100 kilometres into Austria?
Well, that took about 3 or 4 days, like, and then it was a bit difficult, and because there's a Russian troops about, and we can only go all night. And we went village to village anyway, we got to Austria, so without any problem.
And where did you stay? Did the villagers, you know, put you up, or where did you sleep overnight?
Yes, villagers put us up, yeah. Because a lot of people go in, not just the villagers say, stay, come in, stay in, and, you know, no problem at all. Feed us everything. We stayed about 3 or 4 days in one house in Szentesvár falva, yeah, not far from the border. And we just over there. They tell us where to go, where is the minefield, but the minefield was a bit, what you call it. So tell us which way you go, other night. So we went through, no problem at all.
You make this sound so easy, whereas I think to be walking through snow 100 kilometres is not an easy thing to do.
Oh, no, 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 no. Oh, no.
I can tell you, though, my father's response to most major catastrophes tends to be small potatoes. I think after you've been through what he's been through, some major, you know, he cut his thumb off and wrapped it up in a tea towel and took it to my friend, and it was all a bit, it's all small potatoes.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. Angela. I mean, this is such an incredible story. So how did you know that you'd crossed into Austria? What was that moment like?
Well, I think it was a flag. Flag. It was an Austrian put flags, but, and it was a small brook, a small river. Don't know what was the river name. And after we left the minefield, we gone over this river and go in a couple of hundred yards. It was Austrian flag. And there's Austrian border guards. See? They don't say anything. They said, go that way. He said, no, go that way. So, you know, they don't bother you. So, he said, Hungarian, go that way, go that way. And we went to this camp where all the refugees were there. And from there, and fair play, from there, immediately 2 days, we have been put in hotels around there. The Red Cross paid. I remember that my hotel paid by the Danish Red Cross. Great, we had 20 shilling the week and all food, everything. And from there, and I'll, after that, end of a month, the British come in and said, I want to go to America, but they won't fly because it was too snow. So I said, I won't stay now. I said, I'll come to Britain. Britain said, if you come to Britain, you can go to the colonies. What colonies there?
Austria,
Canada, everywhere. So I said, we go to Britain. So we come to Britain and a lot of us stayed in.
It's very random how I became. I should have gone to America. I should have gone to the colonies. And then when he got to Britain, he got stuck on one bus because three buses were going to Coalfields.
Yes, a lot of them there. Yes, got a lot of them gone to South Africa. That's where it's Canada, Australia. My brother gone to Australia, actually.
Yeah, but that was
my
different.
Brother's come after the revolution, I think.
So did you end up using your engineering apprentice as a job in the UK?
Yes, yeah, I was working in...
But this is very random how he ended up here.
It is important in Nangaro in the factory, British Heavy Corporation or something. Then from that, I went to Tyson for a couple of years as an engineer. And then I worked about 5, 6, 7... of companies, you know, in a tool room or things like that. But I worked in the same place first when Hugh's father was working there, but I never knew him.
He was my husband.
Right.
His son-in-law.
Okay. Okay. And so your parents were still living in Hungary, were they?
Yes, yes, yes.
And so were you sending them money or parcels?
No.
Or? No?
No, nothing at all. I was taking present because after that I was going out every other year. Every other year we driving over there. Driving till 1982 was driving. Then after that I forget it's too much.
Yeah.
I was flying every year and taking present and they come over here visiting. You know, it wasn't a problem.
But in the early days, I remember when we used to go out, my mother used to buy reams and reams of material. I used to go to the market to take, like, really, you know, like, industrial amount of material people to make clothes.
Making clothes.
So she'd take, I remember her taking loads.
Good materials, because the material that they're making out there is, you know, which was...
But then she pilfered them of all their antiques that they were throwing out. So she took all the antiques they were throwing out as rubbish from the old farmhouses that she used to bring that back.
Right.
Oh, I can remember I was telling you, I got in the garage a branding iron. Huh? A branding iron for cows and sheep.
Things like this was a... I don't know if you can see it, yeah.
Yeah.
Is it like it's a washing
mango,
it's just a mango thing. They're sure they're all throwing out as rubbish, but my mother, you know, it's all carved and everything.
Oh,
my mother,
that's lovely.
She
mustn't
everything.
Forget that I got a branding iron because we had a big farm, you see. And we had branding iron from my grandfather. I still got two of them.
Wow. Wow. And Angela, are there any other stories that we've not covered? Do you think?
You usually have to have him a few drinks before he tells any stories. What about, there was something about a boy.
When we got to London, all these Hungarians, we had a big hotel and all the Hungarians were put all over the Britain. Buses come in, they said, Scotland is there. And my name was on the bus to come to South Wales. There's only one bus coming in South Wales, the rest of them gone. And there's a young boy was with us, about 14. And as soon as we landed up in Terrywood, in Horton, they call it it was a miners' hostel we've been put into because all the poles was there before we sorted up. And now there, I don't know, somebody come in that he can't stay here. And that boy been adopted straight away in Pontypridd. There's a couple come there, they adopted, all 14 he was. He come back many a time, but I never know how he come there, but he was 14-year-old boy, come from over the Danube somewhere. Never ask him how he come, but they adopted him and schooled him. A couple who hasn't had no children, Pontypridd, they come in straight away, and take him, because he was 14, so wasn't allowed to stay with her.
I do remember when I was growing up that he was sent, which he wanted to get to Glencorrog.
Mm-hmm.
So he was sent, how many years had you been here when you went there?
Where?
Glencorrog.
Oh, I spent about two years.
Yeah, so they basically sent him, learned his English from cowboy movies, and they sent him to Glencorrig, which is basically a one road in town. So yeah. My auntie
Nothing out.
And at the furthest bit where they speak Welsh. So I always remember him going back to visit my Auntie Beattie, his landlady he used to stay with. And she still kept in touch, and her son kept in touch.
Yeah.
So you still see her son comes to visit all these years later.
She's dead now.
No, well, she's dead now. But they sent them into the bloody middle of nowhere.
Yeah.
With, as he said, he got onto it, integrated. But, and then the biggest thing, he never taught me Hungarian.
Well, it's a difficult language, you see. I mean, it's, I know Hungarian, Hungarian is married to Hungarian, and it is still a children is not speaking properly.
Yeah. I know it's a difficult language because I think it's in the same family of languages as Finnish as well. Yeah.
Finnish and Estonian.
And all my family
Estonia now. And Finland is the same.
Right.
But honest to God, I've been talking to the Finns and, how we get together. Do you know the words, what we same words about 1,000 years ago? A sun, a moon, a common, sit down, and horse, a cow, same.
Yeah, I didn't
but,
know that.
Yeah, but a sword and a knife, things like this. But when you speak into the Finn and the Estonian, you can hear their accent is the same as mine, or you got the same accent.
Mm.
I don't know how it comes, definitely, but because when I seen on holiday, when I was at the Finnish couple there, they were talking to English, to the English fella. I said, that's better, the Hungarian. No, he said, we finished now. I said, that's it. Yes, they speak, I thought he was a Hungarian. Yeah.
My dad, apparently, obviously I don't know this, but my cousins tell me he's got very old-fashioned Hungarian accent because where he came from, he's from the lowlands,
right.
Where the family had the land. So when he left, he still had sort of, I suppose, like in Wales, we have different Welsh, South Walian and North Walian Welsh.
Mm. It's just like Britain.
Yeah, but he's got very old-fashioned Hungarian. And then he's got a Welsh Cymru Magyar accent. So,
yeah, it is well. I mean, down there, we wasn't backwards down in the lowland, but it was all farm.
But he came from a very well. We're saying when they were farmers, they had like a summer house and they had servants, and they, you know, so they came from. When I used to go back when I was little, so from the age of four, we'd go to the lowlands where he came from. And, you know, you'd meet these little ladies who'd come in and kiss in his hands because they'd been employed to be the woman who'd rocked his cradle when he was little, or the woman who was sewing his clothes. So they had all these, servants.
My wife can't understand it when she's going to everybody got in kissing her hands. She was there. I said, leave it. Because that's what they bought up.
My grandmother, who his mother obviously had gone from being, which is I find is his story is impressive. But she went from basically being a woman who had servants and all fineries and was in carriages. And when they stuck them into Turkbarland, she, if you'd seen the house, because we went back to the original house.
Living in a stable.
It was basically stable. It was two rooms.
Stable we was living in.
It was basically two rooms with a mud floor. So when we went back there, so she'd gone from living the life of being a rich, well-off family, to living in abject poverty, really living in mud and shit, and then
only thing we had work.
Yeah, and she became then. I remember when she was a cleaner in the Hilton Hotel in Budapest, and the claim to fame is a picture of her with Richard Burton, because she was a cleaner and she'd met Richard Burton. But she went, all she had, I had like a pair of earrings from her, that they'd gone from such riches, and she never whinged, did she? She was an amazing woman, Nana.
Well, we was, where we went to this place, Törökbálint, it's where, in Hungary, was so the multicultural amongst the Germans.
Yeah.
He was Germans, hell of a village, towns German. Now, when the war was finished, the Hungarian government asked him, if you want to Germany, you go to Germany. Don't force them, but a lot of them gone to Germany. And this particular village they called, it was most of a German. So the Germans gone, so and put the Hungarians in from a lowland or whatever. And all we left is a stable to go into.
Well, but did you have some German stables? But yeah, so they went from having a really, and they didn't appreciate it till later when you see the land and everything that they, you know, and the summer houses and the servants that they had, that, you know, that they just thrown down to Turk Barland. And, you know, but then they rebuilt their lives. They got on with it. And
when communism ended in Hungary, was any of that property restored back to the family?
Half of it.
Right.
Half of it. So we're not even well, half of it really, but I had some, you know, and I bought some, but it's, we got a couple of hectares of land out there, so there's no problem on that. But
he's very sentimental, so there was three brothers, him and two younger brothers, and then the government gave them back this land, but then one brother was in Australia, what the hell's he going to do with it, and the other brother didn't want to do farming, so he bought the land because he's, as I said, quite sentimental.
They wanted money, so I bought
and it. And for, you know, the amount of money he had, comparable in Britain, still much richer then than there, so he's got quite a tidy bit of land, which our cousin's farm out there. But that was quite important to him because it was all land, and his grandson, I don't know what he thinks his grandson, who's 26 and is doing finance in Britain, is going to do with it. But
it's, you know, it's another nostalgic thing. See, we had, you know, after the First World War, a lot of people died and a lot of children was, after the First World War, was out of father and mother. And my grandfather, when he come back from the First World War, you take all these children in, whose father and we had two, one girl and one boy, Rosika, and working for us, see? And one was driving a carriage, another one was helping in the kitchen. And anyway, when they got married there, and they had children, and my grandfather was cut a big walnut tree out, and when I born, he made me a cradle. And one of this daughter, she was about 6, and she had 20 penny to rock in my cable all, cradle all the time. Now I still see her every year. I go in to see her taking the chocolate. And,
oh, in the nursing home?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh!
Yeah. I still see her. And she's 5 years older than me or something.
He lives still in the original village where he's from.
Yeah.
Wow.
Where we have to go to see the set. I live next door to a crematorium here. We never visit our dead here. But when we go to Hungary, my God, we visit every cemetery, even the dead Russian soldiers. But she lives in this really nice, much nicer elderly retirement place than we got here, I've got to say, on the edge of the village. So he goes to visit her and has a cherry brandy and gives her chocolates.
She rocked in my cradle when I was a baby.
Oh, that's a lovely story.
Yeah. And she's still about.
Yeah.
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 So Charlie, when you think back to that time in 1956, what would you say is the most memorable thing that you remember from then?
1956, what do you mean, in the war?
Yeah, in the uprising.
The most surprising was when I come in home from work, and I number 13 tram, I got number 13, number 4, go to number 49. And we get at the number 13, and is that those big lorries was there, full of machine gun and guns and things. I suppose just surprised me. Just, well, I mean, I can't believe it. You know, that's what a surprising. You're right, Ellen.
Nobody expects to go to work at 6 a.m. and come home and have to fight the revolution.
But when we went to the number 49, no, number 52, going to the towards the station, the tram was full with civil people with machine guns, grenade and things, and everybody white, red, and banning. Everybody, we kill them all, Well, you know, I mean, not me, but everybody. Kill them all.
Did you have an armband?
I don't have an armband.
Is that why they nearly shot you upside down?
It's
you should have had a bloody armband, Dad.
But I don't have. It wasn't in the farband. I had machine gun, but no, I'm not armband. You know.
That was your downfall.
Oh, because I was the first to get into the radio station anyway, one of the first.
Hello, I'm Craig Donald from Aberdeen, and I support Cold War Conversations with a monthly donation because it marries interesting historical content with fantastic storytelling. Ian is a great gift as an interviewer. He knows his subject so that the conversations are meaningful, but he also allows guests to tell their own story. Cold War Conversations is part of my weekly routine, and I would urge you to make it part of yours.
Want to be like Craig and help to preserve these incredible stories of the Cold War? As a monthly or annual supporter, you'll be able to listen ad-free. You'll become one of our community, get the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster as a thank you, and you'll bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate to find out more, or follow the link in the episode information.
I mean, you mentioned the shooting where you were really close to that AVH guy. Was that
two of them?
Two of them,
and you know what? Two of those AVA jump boat grab hold of me and give himself up, but opposite to the big building now, full of revolution, it shot him dead. Yeah. Now, if you go to the Brodie Sanders Street statue for those two AV guards, statue in the wall for them, they died. That's a communist put it up there for them, see? And,
that's still there.
After the revolution, because they was sacrificed. Not he's given himself up, but it had nothing to do with me, but all his brain was in my shoulder, you know.
But didn't you show me the bullet hole where the...
Oh, yeah.
Where we went back, because they've still got the bullet holes all over Budapest, and we went back to... that's the bullet hole. And he was quite indignant that they shot them because it could have killed him.
No, they wasn't... They was giving himself up, but what were they upsetting? I could have killed...
Yeah.
From them. And he said, we can shot. I said, aye, why? You know, I mean, it's...
How rude.
And was that probably the most scariest situation you got into?
Yeah, I think that was unexpected. I don't know what to do with this two AVOs, you know, just coming and getting himself up, and all of a sudden both of them shot dead together. And I was standing there like a turkey.
Yeah. You were very lucky that your comrades were good shots.
Yeah.
Well, good. That
could
good
be
shots.
Missed. Yeah.
Wow. Well, I've taken a lot of your time, but I really appreciate you telling me your story. That's been so interesting. And as I said to you at the start, I've always wanted to speak to somebody who was, you know, involved in the Hungarian uprising. And you were definitely there.
I was there.
And... you know, the difficulty has always been is finding somebody who can speak to me in English. And you're able to do it in English and Welsh, which is brilliant.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I tell you what, it's been really nice, actually, because we do get him after a few drinks. He'll tell stories. But, you know, you'd swear to God, nothing. As I said, small potatoes. And it's nice. And things like I didn't know about, you know, things like... My son's girlfriend suddenly asks lots of questions you don't think to ask, like, because you lived with him, you don't think to, like, questions, what happened to your machine gun, what happened, you know, I never asked him these questions. It's lovely to hear the answers.
Yeah. Yeah, no, absolutely. And listen, Angela, I really appreciate you answering my tweets and getting me to speak to Charlie. It's been an absolute honour.
And we have further information such as videos and links in our show notes, which will show as a link in your podcast app. Now, you wouldn't be listening to this podcast without the generous support of our patrons. However, I want to especially thank our Politburo level members who are contributing a generous $30 a month to keep us on the air. They are Tony Sowards, Sam Hardwick, Nicholas Butter, Jeffrey Jones, Matthew Comstock, Frederick Esposito, and Peter Ryan. Don't forget, if you like one of those Cold War Conversations coasters and help support the show, then head over to coldwarconversations.com/donate. If you can't wait for the next episode, please visit our Facebook discussion group where listeners just like you continue the Cold War conversation. Just search for Cold War Conversations in Facebook. Thank you very much for listening. Not enjoying the ads? Well, you can avoid them by going to coldwarconversations.com/donate. By becoming a monthly or annual supporter, you'll enjoy ad-free listening, become a part of our community, receive the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster, and bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate for more information.